Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Welcome to The Conversation on this Aloha Friday, March 21st. Today we highlight our talented kama'aina and the national recognition these Hawaii residents have received. Kumuhula Vicky Holtakamini was honored with the Gish Prize, named for silent screen actress Lillian Gish. The win came with a check of close to $500,000. The first woman to win a Hawaii Architecture Award shares how Lincoln Logs and Legos laid the foundation for 50 years in the industry. A charter school wins national recognition for its innovation. Sustainability is in its mission, and the Hope Impact Award comes at a good time. And a talented high school student is destined for great achievements. His first scientific breakthrough relates to our honu.
Support for HPR comes from Nereid Hawaii, which supports nonprofits that are providing affordable housing on Maui to help break the cycle of poverty for residents experiencing homelessness, such as Homemade Hawaii. NereidHawaii.com.
Mokuo Keawe. Join Hawaii Public Radio at Kahilu Theater on Friday, March 21st for a live taping of The Conversation and Kanikavila Sunday. We talk story with author and longtime Parker Ranch veterinarian Billy Bergen, UH biology professor Patrick Hart of Manu Minute, and Hilo singer-songwriter Kainani Kahaunaele. For more information, visit hprtickets.org. Sponsored by Big Island Coffee Roasters and Merriman's Restaurants.
Support for HPR comes from the East-West Center, presenting Asia Matters for America, an analysis of America's interactions with the Indo-Pacific region. Download at eastwestcenter.org, messaging supported by the Turban Chu Fund.
Mai haki mai ole au I nana e pulama Mai haki mai hene e ole au Mai haki mai hele a ole au E haki mai aloha ole ia
You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Kumuhula Vicky Holtakamini was celebrated at Washington Place late last year. She was honored with the prestigious award called the Gish Prize. Last spring, Auntie Vicky brought her halau back to the Merry Monarch Festival after some 40 years. Listen as Halau Pua Ali'i Alima takes the stage. Takamini says the news of the Gish Award caught her completely by surprise.
So I was in shock when somebody called and said, "Hi, you've been awarded the Lillian Gish Prize." And then I immediately started to Google it on my phone. I was like, "Lillian Gish Prize? I'd never heard of it before." I said, "Oh, did I apply for this? I don't remember applying for anything." Then I found out, oh, she's a silent movie actress. I was like, I don't even know her, you know, from the 1920s. And so black and white movies. I said, I remember black and white movies. I'm that old. But I said, I didn't apply. She says, oh, no, you don't apply. You get nominated. So they send out invitations to 100 people nationwide to submit a name to be considered for the Lillian Gish Prize. And then they select 5 individuals to come into their office in New York and sit around the table and review all the nominations, and the team selects the prize winner for the year.
And you were just recently honored at Washington Place. We understand Governor Josh Green says that you have really put Hawaii on the map with this, because prior to this, nobody outside of New York had won it?
That's right. Nobody outside in the 31 years that this prize has been given, no one outside of New York has received it. So the artists that are on this list, if you Google Lillian Gish Prize, they're amazing artists. It's Merce Cunningham, it's Spike Lee, it's famous people. And for the first time in the history of this prize, someone from Hawaii, Kumuhula, whose art form is hula, and from Hawaii, has been nominated and won. I was just in tears when Terrence McKnight, who is actually on public radio, he has a show. He does classical music on NPR, but he's the chair of the selection committee for this year. And I was like, are you kidding me? I said, how is that possible? You know, he says, we only give one prize annually. And this was the mission. And this is what Lillian Gish had wanted, to give one artist annually a prize, a cash prize. When he told me, he says, well, depends. This is very casual, like, depends on when the check is cut. I said, first, he says, you've won the Lillian Gish prize. I said, I'm so excited. But I said, I don't know how I got here. Because I looked on their website. I don't know anybody on their website. Usually you would know somebody, like a program officer or someone. I knew no one on their website. I didn't know anybody on the committee. I researched the committees. I researched the artists. I don't know anyone personally that would recommend me. And so he says, well, you were nominated. You were among 100 people. And we all got in the room. And of course, your name was the last one on the list.
Wow.
Because we go alphabetically. And so Takamine was the last one. And we got to this Victoria Holt Takamine. And it's like, Kumu Hula. And so they started to, they said, well. So they, by then, they had gone through 99 other names. And they each brought in their top six or so, the five. So they had 30 to be tossed around and then ended up with myself and someone else. I don't know who it is. But, and they debated for about an hour and a half. And they decided that I would get it.
So what was it like then? I mean, you flew out there and were interviewed and...
No, not at all. That was it. So he says, I'm going to come over because since you're in Hawaii and everybody else has been in New York, I'm going to come over and present you with a silver medal. And I said, you mean like an Olympic medal? Like I won, I came in second place or something. He says, you came in first. I was like, really? It's like, I said, I've got a silver medal. I should have brought it for you to see. And then this is what he tells me. He says, and depending on when the check is cut, I said, oh, I get a check too. I'm thinking like, yay, anywhere between $400,000 and $500,000. I said, you have got to be kidding me. I mean, how is that possible? The largest one that I know of is like $50,000 for the United States Artist Fellows. I don't know anybody that has had that. You know, it's like the lottery that you didn't play. You didn't put any skin in the game. I was like in shock. So, yeah.
And so are there strings attached with this award?
No, I thought it was going to go to Pa'i. I said, oh, this money, he's going to Pa'i. He says, no, not to your nonprofit. It goes to Vicky Holt's Takamine. I said, oh, I have to pay taxes on that too now. Yeah, so we're figuring that out right now and then figuring out how I can leverage that for, you know, Pa'i. And
well, you know, I mean, I recall going to the fashion shows, you know, that you have put together there in Waikiki, and that is just a stunning visual event. And I remember going there for the first time, and it was just like, yes, it just celebrates the creativity in this community. And, you know, you've done so many things, you know, with your halau and Mary Monarch and, you know, your contribution to hula and mele and oli. And it's just so nice to see Hawaii's talent acknowledged for their contributions.
I was like, can I ask you who nominated me? And this is what I think is very important for our listeners is while we do a lot of good work here in Hawaii, that work has to get out across because nobody would have nominated me that's on their committee or that would have been invited to if I wasn't going to New York or going to Jackson, Mississippi or going to South Dakota or going to Minneapolis. So it's the work that I not only do here, but I do on the continent and bring to Hawaii. So my art space lofts, for example, that we built 84 units of artist housing, rental for artists to live, work, and play in that we built in Kaka'ako. It took me 15 years to get that project up and running. We had to raise $55 million for that. We've got 84 units of artist housing and affordable housing for Hawaii. I was just talking to the educators, State Department of Education, and I should go talk to our governor as well mm-hmm. and some of our state leg because we need housing for teachers. They have housing for teachers in other states, But if we want to keep good quality teachers here in Hawaii, then we have to provide them spaces to live. So I'm thinking that's one of the things that we need to start to advocate for is teacher housing, housing for health care, the real resources that we need to make Hawaii affordable and livable for the people of Hawaii so that they can provide the kinds of services that we actually really need in Hawaii.
Right. So we can keep the kumuhulas, you know, here.
Yes,
right?
Yes. But even our regular teachers that teach school, that teach elementary school and high school that are so valuable for the education of our kids, we need to keep them home so that they can teach our own kids here and not have to ship them off to the continent, you know.
Well, I remember when the artist space, when that project came up before the Hawaii Community Development Authority, you know, those HCDA meetings, you know, and at the time I was like, wow, this is a really interesting idea, you know, and then to see it actually come to fruition is just beautiful.
Because it is a model that I think that we can adapt and adopt for Hawaii and not, and I told our art space president, Kelly Lindquist, we need one on every island, one on every moku to help not just artists, but educators and more of our community. That's the kind of thing is I went to Minneapolis to go get funding to get this project done. I've been in New York to meet with funders at Ford and at Mellon and at Doris Duke to bring money here to Hawaii to serve our community. So we were talking earlier about our Mama Wearable Art Show, leveraging up our artists, making sure that they have a platform to showcase their art form. And also then we have an artist residency program. So we just sent Kanoe Davis from Molokai, another beautiful artist, to Santa Fe Indian Market. Go visit the Indian Market, see what's happening there. You need to experience things outside of Hawaii so you can bring it back here and then leverage your own business. We're doing a Native Professional Development Program for artists at Pa'i Foundation to help them leverage up their game.
I think, what do they say, rising tide lifts all ships?
Yes.
And when you see the artistry finally getting acknowledged on the continent, not just for what you do here for the local community, but what you do for all of the U.S.
Yes, look at Manaola. I mean, he's doing amazing things. Kahululea, you know, they all started at our Mama Wearable Art Show. That was the introduction into fashion and design. So, yay.
Yeah, yeah, the synergy, yeah. So as you reflect back on your journey as an artist, and then just to know that you have gotten this like stamp of approval.
It's been really, for me, I'm really hopeful that it's uplifting the rest of our community, puts Hawaii on our map, puts Native Hawaiians on our map, puts our art form on the map, puts hula up there. We all recognize hula as one of the most prominent artistic practice here in Hawaii. But it doesn't get that kind of recognition across the continent. And so now, you know, what it means for me, like I often say, hula is a form of resistance. So it has helped to perpetuate our Hawaiian language. Because in the 70s, when I unikifamanti maiki ayu lake as a kumu hula, the 70s is when we started our Hawaiian language immersion schools. Halau hula, kumu hula, then uniki. Around that time, all of us were just coming out of, we were all the flower children from the Vietnam War 60s, but graduating and, you know, getting into college and as a graduate of Auntie Mikey, helping to leverage Hawaiian students and Hawaiian language. So in hula, we perpetuate the Hawaiian language, even though that was banned. We perpetuate hula, even though that was banned. So hula has always been a form of resistance. And then, of course, you know, we got very active, politically active in the 1990s with the state legislature to advocate for protection of our traditional and customary gathering rights, the protection of Papahanao Moku Akea, the marine sanctuary for Mauna Kea, all of those issues, land and cultural resources for our people, but also helping tourism to really, I know it's our number one industry, but can you be more responsible? So pushing Hawaii Tourism Authority to open up funding for cultural practitioners so that if you're marketing our culture, what do you do to give back to our culture?
It's that art and activism.
I think that's what it is, you know, the recognition that who pushes our art form to the next level and creates social justice movements. So I think that that's what I've been involved in. You know, I pull from both sides of my family. My father's side is very political. You know, my brother Milton, my brother Daniel, they're all in politics. That's my dad's side. And then my mother's side was a hula dancer. She was the Alahoe queen. She was Auntie Mikey's queen. She was danced for Auntie Mikey Ayu Lake. And so the hula genealogy and the political side of it that kind of merged into, I'm the firstborn. I get to kind of use both sides to leverage everything that I'm passionate about. I never thought I would get into real politics, but I think that it's, for me, I my father has had a strong influence on me and my mother as well.
Yeah, it's under your skin?
Yep. I don't think we can get away from it.
Well, thank you so much for coming in and sharing your mana about, you know, this award and about the culture. And I don't know, any final thoughts, anything you want to share with young artists out there?
I hope I get asked to nominate somebody, because I'm just looking for that next person that can win this award too. I have been asked to nominate people in other like United States Artist Fellows at Taproot that's coming out soon. So I try and look for artists that are doing really, really good work and help to promote them. So I think that that's what I'm hoping I get asked to. Nominate somebody.
Well, you've got the finger on the pulse. Well, mahalo. Thank you so much for
coming
by.
Thank you for inviting me here.
That was Kumuhula Vicky Holt-Takamini talking with us in December about winning the Dorothy and Lillian Gish Prize, which honors an individual who has made an outstanding contribution to the beauty of the world and to mankind's enjoyment and understanding of life. Established in 1994 through the will of Lillian Gish, the prize has honored creatives including Bob Dylan, Ingmar Bergman, and Spike Lee. Oahu resident and architect Carol Sakata made history last spring. She was the first woman to receive the American Institute of Architects Hawaii Medal of Honor. It's the organization's highest award and given to those who have significantly advanced the profession and whose leadership provides inspiration to others. Sakata has been an architect for more than 50 years and is the principal of the local firm CDS International Architects. Its credits include the Grand Wailea in Maui and Tamarind Park in downtown Honolulu. We hanahou the conversation she had with HBR's Russell Subiano about her win.
Is being an architect something that you've always wanted to do, or something that you kind of discovered a little bit later in life?
Pretty much, for some reason, I always wanted to do it. My first kind of recognition that this is what I wanted to do was in third grade, plus or minus. And I used to draw actually just elevations of houses, because we would travel, you know, go places by car a lot and always looking out the window, observing things. My grandmother was a trained artist and my grandfather was a professional photographer. So my sister and I were always geared to, you know, what's around us, observing and taking note of things. Growing up in Seattle, it's a city, so you go down streets wherever and you're going by all kinds of buildings. And for some reason, I guess at that age, houses were a scale that I could identify with. So I'd kind of make up elevations of houses. What shape is the roof? Where are the windows? How big are they? Things like that. And then later on, got involved in doing things more three-dimensionally. We had Lincoln Logs and some plastic blocks that were the forerunner of Legos, but they came with like little plastic doors and windows so you could build little buildings and, you know, put indoors and windows. And when putting them on a level surface wasn't interesting enough, then I'd tilt up a piece of plywood and try to build one that was going up at the side of a hill. So it just, you know, kind of grew from there. My parents would frequently take us to open houses of new homes, because the Seattle Times had a monthly, I think, Sunday magazine section that featured an architect-designed home, and then it was usually open for visits. It wasn't like model houses these days where it had all the furniture and everything. It was basically just the empty house, but you could really see the design, the setting, you know, how it was designed with to fit in the environment and so forth. So I found all those things very interesting and then just kind of kept going from there. My mother, though, was surprised when I was ready to go to college. I was accepted to University of Washington, which was handy because we didn't have a lot of money, but it, you know, it was very close to where we lived in Seattle, and my dad worked there, so I had free transportation. And I just enrolled in the architecture school and was accepted. My mother said, oh, I guess you were serious. You know, all that time she thought it would probably, you know, fade away for something else. But so I just kind of stuck with it.
I know you went to the University of Hawaii at Manoa after attending University of Washington. What drew you to Hawaii?
My husband. He's a local boy. He was born and raised here and went to the mainland for college. And so I met him at University of Washington. We were both in architecture, so we studied together. And kind of what I tell people is I followed him home from school. And that's that's how I got here.
Some of the structures your firm has been a part of designing, Pauahi Tower in downtown Honolulu, which includes Tamarind Park, as well as the Grand Wailea Resort on Maui, and the rehabilitation of the Moana Surfrider Hotel in Waikiki. It seems that architecture is more than just putting together four walls and a roof. How much of it is math and adhering to code, and how much of it is art and tapping into your creativity?
All of those things are obviously involved, but when you're building buildings and designing buildings for someone else to build, actually, and codes are very important because there's a, you know, very significant life safety aspect to architecture and engineering. You want to make sure that, you know, your buildings aren't going to fall down, because that is a possibility, and sometimes there are those kinds of failures. Mm-hmm. So as an architect, we don't design the structural system, but we need to know enough about it to understand the basics, and also with mechanical and electrical and other disciplines to be able to work with the engineers that specialize in those fields and integrate all that into the building. And then you have whatever the intended use is, the owner's ideas about how they want to operate the building, what functions go on there. There's just a lot of things. And the design, actually, I mean, there are the physical aspects of design. A lot of architects gravitate toward, you know, that being, you know, fairly central to what they do in designing a building. And some architects are, you know, have a recognizable style,
right,
that you can tell whose building that is, or maybe who's copying who. But to me, I guess maybe I'm more of a bean counter kind of person who likes details, is the problem, so to speak, the challenge of putting a whole building together and getting it out on time, on budget, meeting the codes, meeting the owner's needs and goals, is actually a design problem. You're always jockeying so many different things. And my particular specialty kind of is in the back office, where, you know, we were working with who, you know, the designer, the main designer of the building, and creating all of the documentation that's necessary to convey that design in a technical sense to a contractor so that the contractor can build it. There's just a whole lot of things that go on behind the scenes, and that's kind of always been the focus of my career, is the more internal aspects of the practice.
Conceptualizing and designing a structure doesn't seem to depend on a person's physical strength or prowess. So it seems like it should be something that both men and women can do. All you really need is like a brain and some hands, right? A brain to think of something, and then the hands to bring it out into the world.
And a voice to express it.
Yeah. Right. You've been an architect for 50 years. How have you seen the industry evolve in that time in terms of making room for women?
It's definitely gotten to be more inclusive, but there's still a long way to go in that regard. And there's a lot of things that may potentially turn women off from the profession. But what we've seen in recent decades is a lot of women are going to architecture school, but there's a fairly significant drop-off between the number of women attending, which can be as much as 50% or more of any given class in any given architecture school, to only about 30% or so of the licensed architects in the U.S. being women. Whether they get sidetracked by family or, you know, other kinds of things that they want to pursue, whether they just use architecture as a foundation and apply it to other kinds of endeavors, it's really hard to say. And I don't think, I mean, I'm sure there's places where it's harder for women to make inroads and women to make inroads at upper levels of large firms, especially on the mainland, but it's not unheard of. It's the more women you see, the more women role models there are, the more people get used to seeing women in those kinds of roles. So I think it's a very gradual thing, but there were not many when I got started, when I graduated from University of Washington. Well, it's a kind of a grueling education. And by the time we graduated, there were only about 33 students left in the class. Oh, wow. That started out fairly large, and of which three were women, so 10%. When I first joined the American Institute of Architects in 1974, there were only about 250 women members in the entire country of AIA.
So, how many total members at that time?
I don't know. Okay. I just remember hearing that number. Okay. The profession is a lot bigger now than it was then. But still, I think it hovers around in the near 30% or in the low 30% of total architects in the U.S. Anyway, it may be higher in other countries.
The AIA Medal of Honor is given to an architect who has significantly advanced the profession of architecture and whose leadership provides an inspiration to fellow practitioners. What does it mean to you to be recognized this way for your contributions to the industry in our state?
It's a very humbling experience and an award that I never thought I would see my name attached to. And a lot of that is because most of the people who've received this award in the past are architects who are, relatively speaking, household names, or at least extremely well-known in the community, like Vladimir Osipov, Frank Haynes from Architects Hawaii. So it's actually very humbling to be considered to be part of that group. And I think I'm the first one who has had such a technical, almost internal career, though I've done a lot of professional service over the years as well, and the teaching and serving on the state licensing board. So, you know, I've kind of, you know, been working in a lot of areas to advance the profession generally. But it's nice, but it's something that I, you know, never thought I would ever receive.
Well, congratulations on being the recipient of the Medal of Honor this year. I really enjoyed our conversation. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you. I enjoyed it also.
That was local architect Carol Sakata talking with HPR's Russell Subiono last February. Sakata's five-decade career was recognized when she was presented the Medal of Honor from the AIA Hawaii State Council. She was the 11th person and the first woman to receive the council's highest award. The first Medal of Honor in 1998 went to Vladimir Osipov.
Support for HPR comes from HMSA. For over 85 years, committed to working together with employers, partners, and healthcare providers to support the health and well-being of the community. Learn more at hmsa.com.
Living on Molokai for many means few options for work and high costs for food and other daily essentials. More and more island residents are turning that challenge into opportunities to revisit cultural knowledge and practice self-sustainability. We'll share how on episode 4 of HPR's award-winning podcast, This Is Our Hawaii. Tune in this Sunday at 4 on HPR 1.
Support for HPR comes from the Honolulu Museum of Art's Doris Duke Theater, presenting 5 Iranian films, including Shada, Persepolis, and the Persian version on now. HonoluluMuseum.org.
It's called the Building Hope Impact Award, a competitive award presented to one of the thousands of charter schools across the country. And last year, a Hawaii school took top honors. SEEKS, which stands for School for Examining Essential Questions of Sustainability, attended the 2004 Building Hope Impact Summit and won Top of Class for Educational Innovation. We Hanaho our interview with Executive Director Buffy Cushman Pates from May of 2024. The award was a bright spot for the school community, which suffered the tragic loss of one of its sixth graders in a murder-suicide case that shook our community. So the news of the win came like a warm hug for the school. Here's Cushman Pates.
It was fantastic, honestly, to be in a group of other charter school leaders who are doing the same challenging work, but they're all innovative school leaders. I mean, everyone that was there was either a finalist for the award this year or had won the award last year or the year before. There were other folks at the summit, too, but most of the folks I engaged with were other winners and people who are leading, many of us founders or executive directors of innovative or impactful public charter schools all across the country. It was just really nice to be with other folks doing such similar work and experiencing many of the same challenges.
And the fact that you've won this award, I mean, gosh, it is nice validation about the work that we're doing here in Hawaii.
Yes, definitely. Definitely. And one of the things I had to do there as part of the determination of who would finally win was I had to give an impact talk, which was a 10-minute talk. They referred to it as a TED-like talk where there were no notes, no slides, just talking about our school. And, you know, I talked about the design elements of our school, but gave the specific examples of a specific essential question of sustainability course, EQS Chi, and how they're examining how can restoration solutions help mitigate the impacts of invasive species. And I talked about how our students go and do invasive algae pulls in Kaneohe Bay on a regular basis and how they did EQS Camp. And they partnered with Malama Manolua and did invasive algae pull there. And really got a chance to talk about not just sort of the design elements of our school, but how they play out and what those experiences are like for students on a daily, weekly, and yearly basis.
You know, I guess, though, when you interact with, you know, your colleagues, right, in other schools across the country, to be able to see the innovation. I mean, I think that's it's so exciting when you see how creative people can get.
Definitely. And then we all, of course, get ideas from each other. We say, oh, how do you do this? How do you do that? Oh, what does your advisor look like? Oh, how do your teachers manage this? And we just can just talk all day long and get ideas from each other, share with each other, learn from each other, and feel both inspired by and supported by each other.
Yeah, the synergy, you just feed off that.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. It was such a great week for me as a leader. It was really validating and reinvigorating.
And so the award comes with a check.
Yes.
And so what's the plan?
We're always expanding on and wanting to invest in our students and the investigations they do, the field experiences, the community partnerships, the project work. All of that takes an investment of time, of course, project supplies, and then paying our people who work at our school as well. You know, the teachers, many of them have leadership roles that help make these things happen and spend time in and out of campus and making sure that all of those programs are funded. As a public charter school, we don't necessarily get enough funds to do all the work that we're doing because we also have to pay facilities expenses out of our per pupil funding. And so we do supplement funding at our school with grants and awards like this, as well as donations from folks. And those things really help us make sure that we can offer a super high quality curriculum that is everything that parents envision and want on the funds that we get. And we need those supplemental funds to help with that. And so it really does help expand our programming, as well as our one-to-one iPad program, things like that that cost money.
Yeah, but really, though, it's not about the money.
It's not about the money at all. It's a grant that has no, what do you call that?
Strings attached.
Yeah, no strings attached grant, unrestricted funds, which just means that we can apply it where we need it the most at any given time, which is super helpful.
Yeah, and this award comes at a time because it's been a tough year for the school.
It has.
You had a loss of one of your students.
Yeah, we did.
It's a tragic community loss for the Oda family and all the schools where those students attended.
All the schools that the students attended, I think all of us in the state on the island of Oahu, I think all of us who are parents, and definitely our school community was deeply impacted by the loss of Orion so unexpectedly and absolutely devastating to our whole school community. I will say that we have a strong community. We're a relatively small school, 180 students, middle school, 6th, 7th, and 8th grade. We have a lot of multi-age classes, so everybody knows everybody, which means that nearly all of us were impacted. Everyone knew Orion. But it also meant that our strong community means we had a lot of structures already in place that we could lean on, and a lot of strong relationships with each other that enabled us to come into school and grieve together, and students and teachers have advisory groups, and they came to school on Monday, and we shared the news. I mean, I don't want to overstate it. It was the most devastating thing I've ever experienced as a school leader and hope to ever have to deal with again. But we have a strong community, and we've put a lot of love and thought towards Orion and his family, and continue to do so.
You know, you're about to close out the year, you know, with the school, and I guess just looking back, and, you know, it's a traumatic experience losing Orion. But, you know, folks have hope, you know, for healing for everybody.
Yeah.
The news of this award is, again, hopeful, right?
Yes.
I mean, gosh, you just want to be able to help each other, you know, whether you're a big school or a small school, a charter school or a private school. To have this award come, you know, during a difficult year. You know?
Yes. It's definitely a bright light in a dark year is the way I would put it, or a dark semester. It hasn't actually been. It's actually been a really great year in a lot of ways. A lot of ways. In other years, this year would feel like a stand-up because this award is meaningful. It's nice recognition. We've got a lot of good things on the horizon coming forward. We've got, you know, a new school year always brings a lot of hope and opportunity and possibility. And being recognized with a national award for education innovation gives us a little bit of inspiration to keep doing the work that we're doing, and a lot of pride in our ability to make meaningful learning experiences for students where they're part of a strong community and they have rigorous academic content courses and they have application of that content in context that is super place-based here in Hawaii, where students are examining questions essential to Hawaii's future. I think being recognized for that model, for this model, allows us to kind of take a breath and look at the big picture and say, we're doing important work, we're doing meaningful work, and it is making a difference in students. And I think everyone will remember this year, for better or for worse, but definitely a year where we grew even stronger as a community, a resilient community, and it's nice to have recognition.
You know, we just had a couple of guests in studio. It's a new school that's starting up this fall. Kalia Academy, mm-hmm. Right, you know, AI, and it was exciting to hear their journey, mm-hmm. You know, parents who just wanted something for their children, and it's taken many years to see this come to fruition, but it was very exciting, yeah. Feeling their energy about, yeah, where they want to go.
Awesome. And yeah, we're 11 years in, and we've we're in a different stage now than we were. I remember that stage myself from 11 years ago. But now to be at this stage and to get national recognition for what we are doing and what we've been doing, it's really gratifying.
That was Buffy Cushman Pates, executive director of the Seek School, which won the top prize for educational innovation for charter schools in 2024. The school's latest honor? Well, this year, fine arts teacher Robin Cohn Murakami was named the Hawaii Charter School Teacher of the Year. Iolani High School alumnus Maddox Springer picked up a huge win before his high school graduation last spring. He took home a top prize at the Regeneron International Science and Engineering Fair. Springer's project helped to explain why green sea turtles in Kaneohe Bay were developing fatal tumors. The Conversation's Lillian Song sat down with him in our studios last May.
The green sea turtles in Hawaii, they're actually special because the tumors can occur internally and externally on them. And it also occurs in the glottis, which is this flap in the back of the turtle's throat. And Hawaii is the only place where the green sea turtles have these tumors on their glottis. And what caused this disease is called fibropapillomatosis. I like to call it FP because it's a very, very long word. When the green sea turtles have the tumors on the glottis, they drown because they can't close their throat when they go underwater. So they just drown. And I mean, that paired with the idea that they have it internally too, which can potentially cause organ failure, as well as they have it externally, which it's an issue because it occurs on their eyes, and that's really, really important for their feeding and for evading predators. And I've seen it on the flippers where it's just completely immobilized because these tumors just envelop them. So I wanted to see if I could try to like reach out to a professor and find this answer. I reached out to 50 professors at UH, and I got one response from Dr. Celia Smith. And she really helped me to look further into this disease. And she really helped try to focus my study in areas that she thought would be beneficial for me. Come up with a plan of attack, if you will. That really was the next step for me in trying to figure out what the cause of this disease was.
But everything was spurred by your curiosity.
Yeah, all this originated from me diving in Kaneohe Bay and wondering why these tumors exist.
Sounds like you were actually on it too, young man. I mean, yes. The fact that you sent out 50 inquiries.
Yeah. Yeah.
I want to find some answers. And Professor Smith actually responded. And then it sounds like she's been very instrumental in your growth,
yeah,
in guiding you along this path.
Definitely.
We're going to fast forward because I just heard about your competition win that you just returned from a few weeks ago. On May 17th, Regeneron and Society for Science, they announced the top winners in the Regeneron International Science and Engineering Fair, the world's largest international high school science competition. And in total, more than $9 million were awarded to the finalists. Now, this competition featured nearly 2,000 young scientists representing 49 U.S. states and nearly 70 countries, so international. Maddox, you were there, and you won the Peggy Scripps Award for Science Communication that came with a $10,000 award.
I did.
So congratulations.
Thank you so much.
What an experience. You were there to share your project on this global stage, and how did you find out that you'd won?
So how the award ceremony works is they wait to call the first place until the very end. For every category, there's 22 categories. And they called the fourth, third, second. So when I didn't hear my name get called in the beginning, I thought it was really over for me. I thought I didn't win anything. I thought I wasn't going to be able to get my project out into the public. But the first animal science, first place, when they called the name, it was my name. And I was shocked. I mean, I was elated. I had just got the opportunity to place first, I mean, across the world. I mean, that has been my dream over the last 2.5 years. Of exploring this project, to be able to place first, not only to win the prize money, if you will, but so I could have a platform to share this project and share my study with media, like here, and with scholars across the world. So that was unimaginable. And then after that, and we went through a couple more ceremonious activities, and they started calling the top 7 awards, which are the grand awards, if you will. And they called my name. I couldn't really believe it because I personally didn't think my project was of the top 7 caliber in the world, but they did. They called my name, and I didn't really know what to think. I was shocked. But it all happened really, really fast. And there I was. I was on stage. I was in front of thousands of people. And I had won this award. And I was really excited because I knew that at that moment that the turtles, that they're going to get the awareness that they really need in order to improve as a species, in order for their mortality rate to decrease, in order for them to be able to perpetuate into the future. I knew that the turtles were going to have a better chance because of me, because of this award. So I'm really, really grateful to ICEF, Regeneron, and the Society for Science for giving me that opportunity to be able to share my project with the world. And not only that, but to help increase the turtles' chances of survival and perpetuate their populations into the future.
Mm. Now, Maddox, doing your project, for our listeners, like, you know, for layman ears, how are you breaking down and understanding what you're learning?
Yeah, so fibropapillomatosis, or FP, is currently one of the number one causes of mortality in all seven marine turtle species, which are all endangered or critically endangered at this point in time, and caused by the latent Kelowna alpha herpes virus number 5. So all that means is that this virus that causes these tumors to occur on the green sea turtles needs to be triggered by an external factor. And a previous study that I looked at found that arginine was at high concentrations inside the tumor biopsies. And wastewater has also been shown to increase the levels of arginine in invasive algae. And because algae is the main component of the green sea turtles' diet, I theorized for my study that I was trying to prove that there's a connection between high levels of wastewater that are outputted from cesspools and sewage treatment mains, high levels of invasive algae, and high levels of arginine being stored in the invasive algae. And I wanted to connect that to the fibropapillomatosis rates in the green sea turtles in those similar areas. So essentially, I was finding an association between wastewater and fibropapillomatosis through the pathway of wastewater to algae, algae to invasive algae to higher levels of arginine stored in their tissue, and higher levels of arginine consumed by the green sea turtles that eat these higher levels of invasive algae.
So primary way that they're getting the arginine is through ingestion. So it's not swimming in the water.
No, it's because invasive algae can uptake nitrogen at tenfold the times that a native algae can.
Okay. All this data collection, it takes time to process, to analyze.
Yeah, I worked with multiple people over the years on this project. It wasn't just me. I worked with a fellow person in my class, Trenton Lau, and Ellie Sugimoto, who's a junior, and both at Iolani right now. And they helped me along the way. Trenton really helped me in the beginning to collect the data and was my team member, and Ellie came in along the way to help me out with that too. It was definitely a team effort. My research professor at Iolani, Dr. Yvonne Chan, as well as Mrs. Kobayashi, they really helped too. So it was really a collaborative effort. I mean, I could not have really done this by myself. Mm-hmm. But it was still a lot of time of me putting in the hours out in Kaneohe Bay and diving or taking algal samples or setting up underwater cameras and such.
Wow. Okay, so learning a lot about your project. And for you, as you head off into your freshman year at the University of Oregon this fall, and reflecting on your high school career at Iolani and how much you've put into this research project, what wisdoms can you share to someone listening today?
Yeah, definitely. So, I mean, one of the biggest things that I've learned is that you have to be okay with failure throughout these types of projects. And I feel like this is with all levels, from being a freshman working on this project, I mean, all the way up to getting a PhD. Being okay and accepting failure and using it to move on is really something that's important, that I found essential in my research. Because there's so many points along the way where you do something, where you try something, and it just fails. And it fails, and it fails, and it fails. And sometimes you just want to give up because you look at your data and you're like, I've shown absolutely nothing. There's no connection here. Why am I doing this? You start questioning why you're putting hundreds of hours into a project if it's just going to turn up with nothing. And I mean, if I stopped, if I got to one of those points now, it's just like, I give up, I'm done. I mean, I wouldn't have gotten to the place I am now. So it's really important that when you have something, when you have a passion, and I think this applies to really everyone, that you really can't just accept failure and give up. You have to take it. You have to take it all. And you have to use it to motivate yourself and to look for other ideas, because there's always something else out there. There's always another test you could do. There's always another place where you could look for your data. just because one test says something doesn't mean that that is really what it is. And I feel like being able to distinguish a failure from an instrument or a failure because of a mistake you did maybe between overall failure of your project is really important, because that's what really allows you to continue your project and be able to eventually come up with a conclusion like I did with my project.
What inspiring words about failure. That was Iolani High School alum Maddox Springer talking to HPR's Lillian Song. He did share one failure with us after collecting and analyzing what he thought were turtle droppings from an Oahu beach. He found out it was actually human poop. Springer's award-winning science project found a link between high levels of wastewater in Kaneohe Bay and fatal tumors in green sea turtles. Springer graduated from Iolani School last year. He now attends the University of Oregon, where he is studying marine biology. Well, that is it for this Aloha Friday. Coming up next week, what researchers on a microplastics project learn from the community. We do welcome feedback. Call our TalkBack line, 808-792-8217, or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find the conversation as a podcast on our website or on Spotify or Apple. Our program is produced by Maddie Bender, Lillian Song, and D.W. Gibson, with support from Savannah Harriman-Pote and Tori DeJournay. The Backyard Quiz theme written for us by John DeMello. Theme music courtesy of Gypsy 808. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us on Monday. Pick up the conversation.